And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Father Carey from L.A. Hey!
Oh, come on. Hello, my name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
This reminded me, I walked in the room, and this looked like the Politburo in Moscow to me, this thing up some hall. I've seen pictures of the... Anyway, that's all it is, you know. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober tonight. I'm deeply grateful to be sober. I like to say that I'm not so surprised that I'm sober, because I like drinking so much right away that the first reflection I had on drinking was, something's going to happen. This is too good to be true. You know, they don't let you keep doing this. Anything this good, they do something to stop you. And I was right. So I'm not too surprised that I don't get to drink or something happen. I am surprised that I'm grateful. I'm surprised that I'm relieved to be sober. That was the part that was unimaginable. And that, as I went through my own journey with this disease of alcoholism, the progressive thing of getting sicker and sicker, and finally deciding that, yeah, I guess I'm alcoholic, and kind of waiting to find out that I wouldn't drink anymore, and then starting again and stopping again and starting again, and having it really... I was somebody who had it really figured out that I should not drink, that I didn't argue with anybody. That's as plain. After the fifth hospitalization, I agreed. It just was a very bad idea for me to drink. And I wasn't showing any improvement in my ability to function and drink at the same time. But what would get me was this, how would I put it? Now, I guess we keep trying to describe what it is that seems to get us. What get me was an awful sinking feeling that my choices were something like this. I either was going to drink off and on, and deteriorate into a pathetic, embarrassing, burdensome, boring pain in the ass to the world, and then die. Or I would find a way not to drink and never have any fun for the rest of my life. And it wouldn't be bad enough that I wouldn't have any fun for the rest of my life. I would have to pretend I liked it. I would have to somehow give the impression that I preferred this because it made sense and it's the way to go. It's certainly responsible for me to not drink and to fulfill my obligations and be a good guy and do the things that I wanted to do. The only thing I could imagine was, in order to do the things I wanted to do and kind of live with some kind of self-respect and live up to some ideals, I would have to spend my life hanging from a windowsill by my fingers on the outside, waiting for time to be up. And so there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm. That seemed to be the two things. And so I was careening between both being good for a while and then being bad when I thought it was important for my sanity. So this, you know, it isn't that I didn't think this was a serious matter. I know the way people talk to us sometimes, you'd think that we didn't notice that drinking's bad for us. You know, I got a good... I think I started to notice drinking was bad for me right away. I'm somebody who didn't have any social drinking to begin with. I had drinking that looked like social drinking to begin with, because most of my drinking in my first few years was not, in fact, terribly excessive. The reason it wasn't excessive is I couldn't get any. I couldn't get very much. I was a seminarian studying to be a priest. I was poor. I was going to a school that allowed no drinking. I was in a religion, though, that did not forbid drinking. I want to point that out. From the looks of this crowd here, a lot of you were sinners from the start, weren't you? You never were. Never were supposed to start up. Anyway, we were pretty tough on sex, but they let us have a drink. I thought, this is one of the things that's all right, boy. And so when I began drinking, I had my first drink when I was 21 after my confirmation pledge was up. And I had done some reading of the big book already because I had written a paper on alcoholism. And read the big book for the paper. And so I was hyper aware of alcoholism and all the stuff about it. And I thought... you know, you got to be careful. Runs in families. You could become an alcoholic. You might be an alcoholic right now, just waiting for the booze to get. That crossed my mind before I drank. And as I gave that some thought, I thought, if it turns out to be that way, it sure is good that I did all this studying and reading and going to meetings for research, because now I'm hip to this whole thing. And if I turn out to be an alcoholic, I'll just quit fast. I'll just quit right when I notice it. I'll let you know how deep my reading was. And when I began to drink, there was enough symptoms of alcoholism the first day I drank to put a person in treatment. If there was someone there to discern the symptoms, you know. But there was nobody there to discern the symptoms. And one of the symptoms you'd think would be the first wasn't there the first day. And that is, I did not get drunk. There wasn't enough, as was usually the case. There wasn't enough. But when I began to drink, I drank with an enthusiasm hard to describe. I had a couple of Manhattans, and I just loved them. Oh! That feeling, that wonderful, the alcohol high, it almost made me think that there was something to reincarnation. It's as if, I had a feeling I remembered this from someplace before. I thought it would be like this. A couple of my uncles were alcoholic, my father was, and I gained a deeper respect for all of the alcoholics in my family. The minute I had a drink, I could kind of say, oh, well, at least they were, you know, I kind of understand. I look forward to the next time I could drink. I was obsessed. I was protecting my supply the first day by taking care. The first urge I had, the spontaneous urge, was to nudge somebody in the ribs next to me. The way you do when you make a great discovery, you come to the, you know, the edge of the Grand Canyon and see this thing, and you say, "Hey, look at this!" You know, share this great discovery. And I was looking for someone to nudge, and there were no alcoholics there that day. They were all standing there having a drink, and they weren't making any big discovery. There was no one to say, "Hey, isn't this great?" And so I didn't say it. And very quickly it occurred to me that not only shouldn't I say it, I got to be real careful not to say anything remotely like that. The instincts of a functioning alcoholic clicked into action the first day, and that is the basic rule for the functioning alky is never let them know anything. Never let them know how bad you want to drink. You know, never let them know what you're ready to do to get a drink. Never let them know what you're ready to do if the first plan falls through. Never let them know you have another plan or a third plan. Never let them know how much you like the drink you got. And never let them know how much it's affecting you. Now, all of the reason for not letting them know any of this is very obvious. Any alcoholic, you may not even be able to put it into words, but we all know what it is. Just, they're going to be after us soon enough. And don't give them any free ammunition, you know. It's going to be, it's tough enough to get a drink without people looking over, checking you out for no good reason. And so, or for a good reason. That was my reaction. I lied right away. Didn't seem like lying at the time. It seemed like exercising my constitutional right to privacy. But you know, I think it deserves the name lying if we are careful not to tell anybody what's on our front burner. If you don't have to tell everybody everything. I think everybody hopes you don't tell them everything. But if I'm not telling anybody what's going on, my main thing, what's got me worried, excited, looking forward to, what's got the most emotional energy going for me, if I don't tell that stuff, I'm deceiving you, you see. As long as I tell a few people and get this up, then I'm in business with the world. But if I hide all that stuff, I got a problem. And when I drink, I hide it all. Because, I don't have to go into it a lot. There's a lot of top secret material when you're drinking. A lot of guys in the service here, you understand that. You don't divulge that stuff. You don't tell them what your plans are, because our plans are a drinking plan, no? And that's the main plan. That's the, I'm not going to tell somebody that I'll drive 50 more miles to make sure we have lunch at a place that serves drinks. I will. I would, you know. And you would too. And we'd both be happy we got there. But we also know that you got to be careful not to tell that to very many people. The majority of people don't understand, willing to spend government money or your money or someone else's money you know what I mean. So I covered up and lied and was obsessed and was very excited. That's enough. You know? And that's the way it started. That's the way it stayed. I went along through the rest of my training in the seminary. I liked it. There wasn't a big suffering thing. And funny, because there was no drinking there, of course, I'm an alcoholic, so I didn't miss it very much, you know. I never got in touch with my feelings very much, and if I don't have anything to drink, it's not so bad. I said, you know, you just don't have anything day after day, you know, you kind of forget about it. So I went along, I got pretty good marks, and I enjoyed it. And I just mentioned this training because there seems to be a contradiction, but there really isn't. You know, I was in a way of life that really encouraged prayer and meditation. We had it built into the structure. We'd get up at 5:30 and report at chapel at 5:50. Let's have some prayers out loud together, and at 6 we'd have silent meditation that would last for a half hour, and then mass that would last a half hour, then have some more prayers, really, and have breakfast around 7:15, 7:20, and then study after that after a cigarette. And that was nice, fine with me. Well, it was a nice way to start the day. I remember getting a job for Hughes Aircraft when I was a student, a summertime job. And after going through the physical, because it was a federal contract company and you had to get this physical, and he checked me all out, and I was, you know, young and did play a little football there in the seminary, and I was very healthy. And he said, there's only one thing wrong. I'll give you a little medication, though, for that problem you've got on your knees. I said, what do you mean a problem? Well, that skin disease you got in your, he named some exotic thing. I said, what do you mean? Well, I said, those are calluses from we had wooden kneelers in our chapel. It's been about I had such good calluses on my knees that I could sleep very peacefully kneeling straight up. Like in the Navy. Anyway, he took him a little convincing for that particular doctor to buy that. I went on and was ordained a priest. I live and work as a Catholic priest in a parish in Los Angeles right now. And I like it. I'm grateful for being in the way of life. But once out of school, the opportunities to drink increased. Something like getting out of boot camp. And so I took the opportunities and went down the tubes quickly. I'm very grateful to report. My heart goes out to those of us who get enough willpower or obsessive-compulsive work ethic to keep it together, to drink a fifth a day for 20 years before they notice something's wrong. I had the good fortune to be the type that becomes a social menace early. I got in, and it was about a year. I didn't get any trouble from them, but I sure was self-conscious and guilty and worried and trying. I was a real booze fighter. I had the two imperatives of the beginning alcoholic who's functioning. The two imperatives are, one, you get as much to drink as you possibly can. And the other imperative is, make sure you never get drunk. And if you pay attention to both of those things all through the evening, it keeps you very busy in your head. And usually I had the good fortune for one or the other of the imperatives to recede a bit. You see, and then I could either get drunk or do all right and not be quite as zealous for getting a drink. But that was there. And I think most of you know how that is. And it's confusing for us poor alcoholics, you know. Like the payoff for really trying hard not to get into trouble is that we imitate social drinkers. We look like we're almost a social drinker when we're good. And isn't that confusing? I mean, I remember I wasn't too far into my drinking when I began to get really down whenever I drank moderately. You know, I felt guilty when I got drunk, and I felt depressed when I drank moderately. The guilt of getting drunk is obvious enough. But when I drank moderately, I felt depressed because, I guess I can control it. I guess that's what I'm going to have to do for the rest of my natural life. If I'm not going to be a sinner and irresponsible and some self-centered, immature, pleasure-loving jerk who endangers the life of everyone around him, I'm going to have to keep trying hard forever. And I know, usually I had that reflection at the end of an evening of drinking where I tried hard and did all right. And usually at that stage of the game, I was absolutely nervous wreck who had noticed that he had no fun. He went through a lot of work and didn't have any fun. Drinking right was no fun and way too much work. And so I was depressed with that and guilty when I drank too much and went along with that for about a year, finding out I was having short blackouts, a little bit longer blackouts, sneaking drinks, trying to forget that I snuck them. I tried... I know that chaser after the 6:30 mass. I really tried to forget I had that one. I have about a third of a bottle of Angelica, 19% dessert wine before breakfast. And then try to smooth out for the morning. I was one of those people who discovered the morning drink because I thought having a drink was a good idea any time I could possibly get one. Here are people that go on for years, having the shakes for years, and finally discover... Well, I started drinking in the morning long before I had the shakes. I just thought it seemed like a good idea to me if there was a bottle nearby. Also, that one drink in the morning, when I got more practice later on, it would be drinking in the at night. And wake up in the morning and they say, you know, a little hair of the dog straightens you out. Oh, it got me drunk. I would, I'd be drunk just like that if I started drinking in the morning. So I thought, after about a year, I was very concerned and I thought, well, this looks like it. You know, I was listing the symptoms, blackouts, heavy duty obsession. When I have one, I'd not drink for a while and have one drink, and as soon as I had one drink, I knew that I didn't know what would happen next. Really unpredictable behavior. I thought, well, I guess I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I'm a beginning. Maybe I'm a pre-alcoholic, and if I am, I guess I'm going to quit pretty soon. I wonder when I'm going to quit. It really had me in suspense. And I went along for almost 2 years, and I finally quit. And I thought, well, by God, look at that, I quit. I couldn't believe it. I was waiting so long. Actually, when I noticed that when I did quit for, I didn't consider myself quit until I had about 3 or 4 weeks. And then I realized that I had been quitting a lot in the previous year. But I would start again so soon after I quit that I didn't want to count it. You know, I was quitting. And then I went on. I had about 6 months in the wagon. Started drinking again with the thought that anybody who could quit drinking for almost 6 months had proved they could quit. And as long as you're sure you can quit, you might as well start. Because if there's any trouble in the future, you just have to quit fast. I mean, you just quit fast. That's all. You nip it in the butt. You know what I mean. And so I resumed drinking and got to quit a lot after that. I quit every few days. I quit so often over the next few months that when someone would offer me a drink, I'd say, just a minute, let me figure out if I'm quitting or not. I really didn't know walking down the street whether I was in one of my quit periods or not without giving it a little thought, trying to rack my brain. And then I decided, you know, your trouble is that you quit too much. If you quit drinking for life 10 times a month, it affects your self-esteem. And I figure with my self-esteem so battered by quitting so much that I naturally had a drink. So I quit quitting. And thought if I just accepted myself as a drinking person and quit being such a perfectionist, a neurotic, hung-up, uptight perfectionist, and just smoothed out a little bit and accepted life and myself, I'd probably do a lot better. And with that theory, I drank a fifth of scotch a day. I always like to put in a few words about the experience of drinking a fifth a day. It's serious drinking, not record-breaking drinking. I always like to point out that when I mention drinking a fifth a day in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the only gathering in our society that you can mention drinking a fifth of booze a day and have nobody bat an eye in the room. Nobody, nobody flinches. Nobody even, not a sound, you know. Try it in any other group. We know it's about half as much as two-fifths a day. But drinking at that rate, I felt very deprived. I felt like I hardly ever got a drink. I was constantly spacing them out more. Don't, come on, you can't finish too early. You got to make this last. You can't get another bottle. I used more willpower and self-control keeping it down to a fifth a day than any activity in my life before or since. I also was exhausted at all times. I was tired when I was rested up. I was bored by all activity. All normal activity was boring. the naturalness is drained out of life. Everything had to be thought through and decided on. There was two things I could do spontaneously. Collapse and split. If you saw me suddenly leave the room or collapse, you knew I was being sincere. Otherwise, it was kind of studied, you know, go through it slowly. My attitude deteriorated. I became deeply suspicious of cheerful people. If anybody remember those, that's the image of these women picking up their kids after school. It's still in my mind. I can just see them now. Getting out of a station wagon and saying, "Hi, Father." I figured that anybody that cheerful in the middle of the afternoon was either so dumb that they had no contact with the tragic dimensions of life, or they were on speed. Because life is tough. And what's so funny anyway? And the heaviness and the emptiness, you know, was it. And I didn't know. I felt this terrible lack of vitality, you know, lack of energy, lack of interest in doing anything. And then thinking forward to having to do stuff forever. The only thing that held any promise of relief to me was a drink. And that's drinking on a good day. That's when there's no trouble. You know, the pain of alcoholic drinking when there's no trouble and we're good at it is so extreme that getting into trouble is a relief. Isn't it great to finally become a disgrace to your family and a menace to society? I mean, once we go public, we can get help. Before that, it's very lonely. I mean, I'm spending half the day proving I'm all right. How can you go tell somebody, "Gee, I'm hurting, and what can I do?" We can't say that because we're all right. By golly, nobody can. That's the way it was in the good old days. And I had the good fortune to start missing things. That was what got me into trouble. Mostly was just missing. I had a pastor who was very good for me. He was the kind of pastor every alcoholic should have, the kind of commanding officer that wants you to do all his work. just do some of it anyway. And I began to fall down on the job and just not be there. I was there quite a bit, but I wasn't there when I was supposed to, and when I didn't expect me, I'd show up. mostly not be there. And so we had this showdown business, and I agreed never to drink again. I thought, I always do this when I was caught. I'd say, "I have a suggestion. I'm just not going to drink anymore." And they'd say, "Well, that's just what I was going to suggest." And I'd say, "Fine, we have this thing." And I lasted a few weeks and was drinking again and got into trouble again. I'd make my suggestion again. Then I got a little old. But then he kicked me upstairs. I had to retort to the boss's boss about my problem. And then the boss's boss's boss. That's as high up as they go, locally. And I was... I know that... It was after the last reprimand, I lasted several weeks again, started drinking with a few of the men in the parish who were waiting for their wives to get done with the parish fashion show, and decided to have a little double scotch with the boys of a Sunday afternoon, and I arrived home about 7:45 in the morning. A lot of class to it. I came in with the school children. I timed at parish who were waiting for their wives to get done with the parish fashion show, and decided to have a little double scotch with the boys of a Sunday afternoon. And I arrived home about 7:45 in the morning. A lot of class to it. I came in with the school children. I timed it to arrive with the kids, and I kind of walked across the playground with all the children while I was staggering, dragging my sweater on the ground. Isn't it something? We just have a knack for doing these things. Anyway, I was fired, and I got to go in the hospital merry-go-round, and that was very instructive. This was in '67 that happened, and I was in aversion treatments. And if you have a sense of good sportsmanship and any brains left, you're supposed to be able to stay sober for the rest of your life. But if you've had 5 of these sessions in 10 days, and I had 5 in 10 days, and I thought, well, they got me fair and square. It's obvious now. I'm an alcoholic. The first drink gets me drunk. You bet. I was a very good patient. I know how to make alcoholic counselors feel fulfilled. So I got out, and I was just enthusiastic. I mean, I was almost enthusiastic about the whole thing. It's fine with me. And I got down to business, and I got another assignment, and I got settled down, and thought, well, this is it. It's, a little tough, but that's clear. Don't get to drink anymore. That's that. And I had two kinds. I drank again. I think the first time I drank it was just the revelation obsession, The kind that is, we get the message, in 20 minutes you're going to have a drink. And I said, well, I'll be damned. I thought I'd last longer this time, The hospital and everything, It's a lot of money for that hospital. I thought I'd have a little respect, go at least 6 months. That was on a Thursday. By that Sunday, I had a dinner appointment. One of the pillars of the parish invited a few people over and invited the new priest over to check them out. I started drinking 3 days before that dinner. And drank a little wine during the day and through the night for 3 days. And when I got there, I was feeling kind of funny, but I felt I was doing all right. And just had a little wine. And they called dinner, and I thought, good. And I was feeling a little bad, a little under. But I pictured my liver taking care of this stuff. If you've been in treatment, you've seen these charts of the description of a ethyl alcohol molecule. The CHO, all this stuff, and then it breaks down into acetaldehyde and water, and then into sugar. And I pictured my liver just taking care of all this alcohol, just breaking it down. By dessert, I was going to be fine. And but food. I was at the head of the table, as a matter of fact. I mean, the people were kind of out sitting like that for me, and they had roast beef and some red vegetable and mashed potatoes, as I recall, and some gravy on the mashed potatoes. And the next thing I knew, I was down there. I came up hoping nobody had noticed. And, I said, are you all right, Father? I said, oh, just fine. I'm a little tired. I thought I'd take a little nap with the mashed potatoes. And what made me mad is that I got all straightened up and woke up down there again. I never remember going down. I just doing fine and wake up with the mashed potatoes. I do fine, wake up down there. I got to go back to the hospital and had aversion treatments over again. The whole batch of them over. I was contrite, and I figured, no way am I going to drink again. No way. It's impossible. It's just too embarrassing. Lasted almost a year. Almost a year. I think I drank out of sheer self-pity. I was good so long. Did not occur to me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because I already knew and agreed to everything I figured they'd say in AA. That there's a disease, first drink gets you drunk, you need God's help. I agreed to all that. And of course, I was praying the way a self-will-run-riot immature alcoholic prays. I knew a lot about prayer, but I didn't know very much about me. I knew the right things to do in prayer, but I didn't know I was doing some of the wrong things, adding them on. What I was doing was praying like the man who had lost his legs. I was praying to grow new ones. I wasn't exactly praying not to be an alcoholic, because I knew intellectually that you stayed an alcoholic. But I was praying, in effect, to feel like a non-alcoholic. I thought you're supposed to feel like a non-alcoholic. I thought, God help me, and the way I'll know you're helping me is when I feel just fine and smooth and poised and energized and cheerful and helpful and wonderful. And if I don't feel all that, screw it. Very humble prayer. And I didn't know my prayer was that willful or arrogant, because I wasn't praying it in an arrogant mood, you know. I think I've been more arrogant when I'm in a kind of a meek and humble looking, kind of a beaten down thing. You ever talk to a skid row alky who's really sick? Offer him some help and find out there's 13 conditions. 13 conditions at least before you're allowed to be of any help. And I'm a skid row alky. I'm that son of who I am. And I couldn't see that. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and have Protestants describe their prayer. For me to find out that I had self-will run riot in my prayer. And when you have that kind of self-will prayer, it gives prayer a bad name. You know, because your batting average is always pretty low. You figure, well, you know, all-powerful God, huh? Not coming through very often as far as I can see. Not according to the list I'm turning in to the heavenly pharmacist. I had to go back to the hospital a lot. The fifth time back, they asked me never ever to call them up again. I didn't. And the sixth time, I was detoxed in a regular psychiatric hospital in Los Angeles. After that, I was shipped back to New Jersey to a recovery house for priest alcoholics. The main thing we did in that place was go to AA meetings. Thank God. And I thought, well, I'll go to meetings. I'm the compliant type. I'll go along with it. I didn't think for a minute the meetings were going to do any good, because I already knew all that stuff. But as I went to the meetings, I was touched almost immediately. And I have this bias of a lot of people who go to school too long, and even people who don't go to school too long. We have the same kind of a thing where I figured that I have to find something out. I'm going to have to get a deeper insight. I'm going to have to see around the next corner. And then maybe if I really figure something out more completely, something will click and I'll be all right. Maybe. And I figured there was little chance of that with these amateurs in Protestant church basements with no visual aids. I was touched. I didn't even know I was touched. I didn't know what it meant. I was surprised that I liked going, you know. I was surprised that I even looked forward to when we got to go to the meeting. And I was thinking, well, we're going to Morristown again, huh? Oh, good, that's fine. Going into Summit, huh? Let's go. Of course, when I got to the meeting, I could hardly wait to the meeting to get over. You know, I could hardly wait to get to the meeting. And then when the meeting started, I began to worry that they might talk overtime. If someone talked 2 or 3 minutes overtime, I would go berserk and twist the chair apart that I was sitting in, because the covenant is till 10 or 9:30, whatever, 8:30 in this case, because I got to get back to my 12-step house and sit there. Anyway, I wish I could tell you that I don't feel that way anymore. If I were you, I'd be nervous. These people that drive a long way to a meeting think they can talk as long as they want sometimes. Anyway, I was touched and I was drawn, and I picture it this way, that my higher power decided, or my higher power drew me in this thing. Because I'm not the type that lets down, it seems to me. My arrogance is pretty strong, and he just drew me in, and I found myself in the meeting like a child. I was just going around to the meetings and being an alky, hanging out with alkies and talking to people and saying hi and reading the book. And I didn't decide to be a good AA member. I just didn't have any more tricks up my sleeve right then. I was fresh out of ideas. And so I was still having wonderful insights, of course. I could hardly wait to lay on you at participation meetings. And when I would get my wonderful insights and share them, that's part of the program, but not too big of a part. The big deal that was going on was that I discovered myself being willing to do AA like a child. And somehow that image is the key thing to me. We do it like a child. We just do it. And it says, you know, utilize, don't analyze. Well, telling an alcoholic not to analyze is like what, you know? Telling the Pope not to go to church or something. We're going to analyze. You know, if you're the analyzing type, you just can't help it. So analyze. There's no way I can keep myself from analyzing. But the program, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't hurt you too much to analyze. As long as you utilize first. As long as we're utilizing and then kind of noticing what we're doing, that's okay. But we don't just, if we only analyze, then we're dead. What we got to do is just go along and say, okay, you guys, some of you stay sober and you got a look of relief on your face. You don't have to be loaded. What do you do? And boy, will you ever get a bunch of suggestions if you ever ask that question. We get the suggestions of the 12th step and all the particular suggestions of the person you're talking to. And we start doing this thing and just doing stuff. I didn't think I was doing anything special. When I started writing my first inventory, kind of a dumping the garbage inventory, I felt pretty self-conscious. And I felt I find it very difficult to write. And I thought, this isn't going to work. I mean, this is not going to work. I've been in therapy. I paid good money talking to a professional, getting down to the deep things, and I'm supposed to write about 3 or 4 pages and have some miracle thing. Are you kidding? I mean, this isn't going to work. But I wrote out what I could write out and shared it, and sure enough, it didn't work. But by saying it didn't work, I mean it didn't work my way. It didn't resolve all the conflicts of my life and send me soaring into the sunlight, totally integrated and transcendently intelligent, able to solve everyone else's problems and my own. In that sense, it didn't work. However, I haven't had a drink since I wrote that inventory. So you might say it worked, didn't it? Snuck some pills, which I changed my sobriety date for, a year later. But that was the start of the real program. And I noticed, and as I went along and just did this thing, and I didn't think of myself, this thing, doing it like a child. That phrase occurred to me last week. I don't usually use that. But it seems to be a nice way to describe it right now. As I went along, and I felt a little bit better here and felt at home and going along, then I didn't have a spiritual awakening with the blinding light or the Bill Wilson type, but I had something where I was still in a recovery house, and it came, it was like the whole atmosphere changed. Something very profound changed. I I discovered that I was being held up in sobriety. I discovered that my sobriety was not something that I was holding, that I was doing, but I was something that I was being given. And that it was, and that I was a fortunate man, that something's being given to me beautiful and good, and that I'm the same old self-centered, immature, impractical, frightened person who's being held up in sobriety, and that I'm into something different, and it's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And it's still going on. And once that started to become a kind of a little more clear, I won't even say it was so clear. It was definite, though. It took on some body, you know. I went way past my time to get drunk again. I was a periodic on a 3-month cycle. And I knew that the old pressure wasn't building up. And I was hanging out with alcoholics, and I was feeling lucky to be sober. I was feeling graced. And I got interested on how to keep this thing going. And now, I knew I didn't get it going, but you were telling me, if you happen to notice something good starting going in your life, being sober a day at a time, we have some suggestions on how to make sure it keeps going. They're called 12 steps. 12 steps and hang out with alcoholics. And do them like a child. That means you do them earnestly and badly. Because if you're any kind of an alcoholic, you'll be able to criticize your performance on anything. You'll notice that you're not doing them perfectly, and you'll feel terrible about that. That's part of the therapy. If we felt wonderful about every step we did, we'd be as obnoxious as we were before, probably, before we came in here. You also would recover so completely that newcomers would be afraid of you. Nobody would talk to you. But your character defects are still so glaring that you don't scare away newcomers for the most part. You know what I mean. And that's the most exciting thing that's ever happened. And that's basically what's going on right now. I got to where I started participating in the program, and I want to participate in this program. I like to go to meetings, and this is the center of everything that makes sense to me. It's the most interesting thing in the world. A lot of people have their thing about religion, and I'm not going to talk about religion, it's not a problem, but I want to talk about my experience of getting so excited about finding, really experiencing God's touch, so far as I can tell, through Alcoholics Anonymous. And people have asked me, well, didn't that kind of make you feel that your religion let you down, or isn't this better than church, or something like that? And I'm sorry, it doesn't strike me that way. Yeah. It strikes me that my higher power touches me through the 12 steps in this program and lets me be in good enough shape to go to church. I'm not in good enough shape to go to church unless I am doing the full program and, in a sense, putting it first. See, when I put the program first, then I don't have to twist what I hear in other places. Whenever I take something back to my old, to other priests, and I'll make one of our AA discoveries about the spiritual way of life, and I'll think, wow, why didn't I think of this before? You know, why? Wait till they hear about this. And I go back and tell them. You know what they always say? Well, we've always said that. Every time, it seems like to me. One of the times it tickled me was that I decided there's no such thing as punishment. I mean, a loving God doesn't punish people later, do things to them. That the punishment metaphors in Scripture are metaphors or similes, whatever, for the very real chaos and pain and tragedy that results from the results of our behavior. When I act in an unloving and destructive way, it really hurts, all right. Hurts me worse. And it puts me in a position where I'm unable to welcome the good. And I went on, I kind of developed this a little bit, and I have a consulting theologian. His name is Frank. He's my classmate. He was the smart guy in class. They sent to Rome and got a doctorate and taught on a graduate level for years. So I checked things out with Frank, and I said, I explained this thing where I think there's no such thing as any added punishment later. Anything that's punishment just arises right out of what we do. And that since God is love, the only thing he knows how to do is love. And, of course, it's love is terrible if you're not ready for it. Might say if there's anything hell is being loved by somebody you're not ready to be honest with. And I say it's, so I did this whole thing and I said, so therefore I don't think there's anything such thing as punishment laid on somebody later. What do you think of that? No, he said, anybody knows that. So I stopped announcing these eternal truths and trying to and I said, come to an AA meeting. I'll introduce you to a few people who don't know that yet. The biggest subgroup in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, are the ex-Catholics. Anyway, I'm very grateful to be sober. And this, I promise to quit by the time that thing gets down to, but I'm not going to quit any sooner than that. I want to say a thing about carrying the message. And this is to my fellow self-centered alcoholics. If any of you identify with being self-centered and immature, I want to say that one of the most embarrassing things in the program to me was finding out that I wasn't interested in helping anybody. I thought, you know, for someone whose profession it is, we're going to find out. Every place in the big book it says, you know, we took this step so that we're better fitted to be of service to God and our neighbor. Over and over again, the big book is full of this. And I thought, and I approve of that. And I think that's the way to go. And I was embarrassed to have to admit that I'm not that interested in it. I hope I am someday, but right now I'd at least like to get my act together, become happy. And if I have any time left over, what the hell? And then as I got in the program, I noticed that you can, if you participate in the program and go to meetings and give your phone number out, you can't help it, you see. People will just get you involved somehow. If you don't fight it off too much, you will get involved. And every time I get involved in being of service, I love it. I like it. And just hope they don't catch me again very soon. And then if you do more service, you get hooked up with other people who are of service, and they're always the ones you like more than the other. I mean, you get along better with people of service because they got kind of a generous spirit, and they're the other self-centered people who can't help it in giving service. It agrees with me so deeply to be of service that I'm really lucky. It's wonderful to be of service. It makes me feel like a human being, freed from my self-obsession for a few minutes anyway. And I'm deeply grateful to my higher power working through the program that I get to be of service, and I just can't maintain interest all by myself in being of service. And I absolutely need the structure of this fellowship to get trapped into it again. And I hope I keep getting trapped, and thank you very much.
All right.